All right, everybody, thanks for coming. We are very lucky to have three important guests, although one of them is not really a guest, it's a professor at the LSE. Alejandro Werner, there with a red tie, is the head of the Western Hemisphere Department at the IMF. Jorge Roldós, right here, is the deputy head. Veronica Rapaport is a professor in the Department of Management, and she will be the discussant. She will say a few wise words on what the IMF should or should not be forecasting for Latin America. But we have the privilege of getting firsthand a presentation of the report. So Alejandro will go first. Jorge will speak next. And then we will open it up to Veronica and then to you guys. Professor.
Thanks, Andres. So I'll take it from there. Okay. Let me...
For some reason, this always happens, right? This is a constant feature of human endeavor that always the PowerPoint presentation gets stuck.
Will not show up.
But Matea will solve it. Okay. He solves everything.
I mean, I can start without the and when we get the slides, we catch up. So thanks for coming. I mean, we came here to present our outlook for Latin America. We put out our world economic outlook two times a year, our full outlook in the spring and in the fall, and then we update the outlooks in the summer and at the beginning of the year.
Great. That's it. If I can do that, I'm going to sit here, but I'd like to look at the pictures.
Can you do that? Okay. So that's, Very good. So let me see here. Mine is working.
Now it works.
Okay. So this is basically the outlook that we put together in October of this year. And we do the full World Economic Outlook, and then each region or each department that covers each region does a more detailed analysis of what we're expecting for the region as a whole. So we start with this slide that actually summarizes our outlook for the world economy. We're seeing the world economy slowing down significantly from 3.6% growth in 2018 to 3% this year, and we're expecting some pickup in 2020. As you can see, the U.S. continues to do relatively well with a slowdown from 2.9 to 2.4. We're seeing an important slowdown in the euro area with Germany, I mean, going to a technical recession now, but with a significant slowdown. I mean, some slowdown in China. And basically, throughout 2019, we have seen very strong signs that the trade conflicts are generating a significant negative impact on the world economy. We have seen a significant slowdown in trade around the world. We have seen a very important slowdown in investment. Manufacturing activity in the world is in recession levels. So basically the whole compound that is mostly associated with global value chains in the manufacturing industry, in trade, etc., has slowed down significantly, affecting countries in Asia, countries linked to China with heavy manufacturing like Germany, and the U.S. being a much more closed economy and basically not being that affected, and basically having the slowdown that was expected as the significant impact on aggregate demand associated with the tax reform of the tax administration that had an important effect in 2018 starts to wear down in 2019 and 2020. we have seen an important, I think around 80% of the economies in the world this year are having growth that is lower than the growth that they had in 2018. And that is why, obviously, I mean, this hypothesis that it's basically an aggregate driver affecting this whole economy is associated to trade really matches up with the data. On top of that, we have had important emerging markets slowing down significantly. Look at Russia, South Africa, Brazil, Argentina, etc., with significant slowdowns. In the case of Brazil, it's not a slowdown, but basically has continued to grow at a very low rate in the last few years. And the last thing I want to say from this chart is that the recovery we're expecting for 2020 is basically led by the fact that emerging markets are expected to pick up. If you look, I mean, we're expecting advanced economies to continue to grow at 1.7 and emerging markets to accelerate from 3.9 to 4.6. And that is why we think this is a relatively highly vulnerable recovery, because, I mean, our teams expect that those countries that were doing poorly in 2019, most of them will recover part of what they lost in 2020. So we are betting on a synchronized, idiosyncratic recovery. So a lot of the emerging markets that are doing poorly, for example, Argentina, I mean, is not doing poorly because of the manufacturing cycle or the commodity cycle. I mean, it's mostly about idiosyncratic factors. The same is true for the case of Brazil, why they recovery did not happen, etc. So, I mean, although our teams assume that all of them will recover and there's substantial data to point in the direction that there will be some recovery, obviously the risk that maybe 20% of those countries or 30% of those will not recover will affect the recovery that we have in place here. It's not like we have already seen a significant increase in commodity prices in the second half of 2019, and that's going to feed into the development of these countries in 2020, and therefore there's an important single driver of this recovery that it's a little bit already in the cards and led significant substance to the recovery. So that's why, although we have that expected recovery, it's a very vulnerable recovery for next year. And if the world economy continues to grow at 3%, this will be the lowest rates of growth since the global financial crisis for the world in two consecutive years. So this is as a backdrop for the economies in Latin America. Obviously, this world economic deceleration has been mostly reflected in when you look at the growth of Latin American exports. Those exports were growing, I mean, at double-digit rates, and that double-digit rates have basically collapsed to zero in 2019. When you look at the average growth rate of Latin American main trading partners, we have also seen a significant slowdown, and we're expecting these low rates of growth to continue in the next 5 years. And with respect to commodity prices, there was a huge drop in commodity prices in 2014, 2015. Some mild recovery after that, but the expectation is that commodity prices will remain around the current levels for the next few years. So in that sense, I mean, when you look at the real side of the economy, I mean, the drivers, the external drivers of economic growth in Latin America will not be coming from outside, because the rest of the world or the main trading partners of Latin America will be growing less. So trade will not be as a strong push. Commodity prices will not be there. The only positive factor for the region as a whole is the financial conditions. At the end of the day, the significant slowdown in world economic growth has led to the major advanced economy central banks to actually accelerate the loosening of monetary policy. The Federal Reserve Board in the U.S. that was in this phase of normalizing monetary policy towards their neutral rates, basically increasing their Fed funds rate from zero to around the range between 2.5 and 3, has basically stopped that normalization and started moving the interest rate in the opposite direction, basically because inflation in the U.S., although the U.S. is doing quite well, unemployment is at a historically low level in the U.S., inflation has not picked up at the place that they thought. Also, looking at the deceleration of the world economy, they're concerned that eventually can have a negative effect on the U.S. economy. And given that the U.S. have lived for so many years with an inflation rate that has been below the target, below 2%, I mean, the Federal Reserve is much less concerned about having a couple of years with inflation above 2% than actually concerns about the economy going into another recession in the next few years. No? So that's on the U.S. So in Europe, I mean, after a couple of good years in economic growth, that actually opened the door for the ECB to start also increasing rates or at least thinking about undoing their lax monetary policies, the slowdown that they're having have actually pushed the ECB towards another round of loosening of monetary policies. So all of this has actually generated this very important decrease, let's say, in the long-term rates in the U.S., but around the world, in which you have, I mean, in most advanced economies, 10-year rates that in real terms are negative, and that has been reflected when you look at Latin America, 10-year U.S.-dominated, U.S.-denominated financing costs to actually follow what has happened with the U.S. rate. So generating an important loosening in at least dollar-denominated funding costs for Latin American sovereigns and also for some Latin American corporates. As you can see, I mean, there has been some increase in spreads, but I mean, throughout 2019, corporate spreads have been relatively constant as sovereign spreads, and therefore the yield for borrowing in U.S. dollars for both the sovereigns and average corporates in Latin America has fallen significantly. That led to an important influx of capital in the first 4 months of the year, and then we have had kind of a similar pattern of capital flows towards Latin America. So in a sense, I mean, the real side of external factors being negative for the region, the financial side being relatively positive for Latin America. However, I mean, we have seen a significant slowdown in the economies in Latin America. As you can see there, I mean, last year Latin America grew at 1%. In 2019, we're expecting growth to be 0.2%. I would say that, I mean, there's maybe three groups of countries that explain this deceleration. First, you have, let's say, up to October of this year, the well-behaved Latin American countries with a very robust macroeconomics and financial sector, with relatively well-operating floating exchange rates like Chile, Peru, Colombia, etc. These economies have slowed down basically due to international to the slowdown of the world economy. So you can quantify this slowdown, and basically the slowdown that we have seen can be mostly attributed to the slowdown in the world economy. Then you have economies like Mexico, like Brazil, etc. In the case of Mexico, that they have slowed down much more than can be attributed to the slowdown in the world economy. On the one hand, Mexico is linked to the U.S. that is not doing that poorly, although it's linked to the U.S. through manufacturing that is slowing down significantly. But the Mexican economy went from growing at 2% to growing almost at 0% this year. What has happened in Mexico? I think a significant change in the design of microeconomic policies. The new government in Mexico has maintained, I think, a significant commitment to macroeconomic equilibrium, but on microeconomic policies in the energy sector, in the infrastructure sector, in the health sector, etc., has sent in some cases has significantly changed the regulation and the rules of the game, and in other sectors has sent a signal that it's going to change these rules of the game. That has led to an attitude of wait and see by investors, and therefore the economy has slowed down. In the case of Brazil, I mean, you had the new government of Brazil coming in. I mean, Brazil went through a significant recession 2 or 3 years ago, basically associated with the important fiscal problems that Brazil was facing, but more than that, to the blow up of the corruption scandals, the impeachment of the president, etc. That's it. That's past. Say that's in the past of the Brazilian economy. However, looking forward, I mean, Brazil has to deal with a significant, with many problems. On the one hand, it has to deal with a huge debt issue. Debt to GDP in Brazil has reached 90%, and it continues to grow, so they have to do an important fiscal adjustment in the next 5 years. To do that, the first stage in this consolidation was a very important pension reform that was basically just passed by the Brazilian Congress. I mean, given the uncertainty of whether this new agenda that is basically focused on consolidating public finances, on privatizing significant public sector assets, and opening up the economy. I think investors have been a little bit also on a wait and see attitude to see if this was actually going to be implemented by the current administration, and then we have the political capital to undertake this agenda. And therefore, although we were expecting in our past outlooks the Brazilian economy to accelerate growth this year on the back of the announcements of this important agenda, it seems that basically the private sector has been much more prudent in reacting to the announcements, and it's waiting to see if this agenda eventually is implemented or not. And then you have the countries that are actually undergoing severe balance of payment crisis, like Argentina and Ecuador, in which the crisis has deepened in 2019 as basically problems of credibility with implementation of programs to correct these imbalances actually flare up, and therefore the recession in 2019 is going to be deeper than what you thought. And then you have Venezuela. Now Venezuela has gone through the deepest historic contraction in economic activity in the history of Latin America, and almost in the history of our database in 1970-1960.
Who's bigger?
Maybe Zimbabwe. Mm-hmm. But I don't have the slide now, but we have a slide basically looking at our database since 1970 of the countries that have had the largest contraction in a five-year period. And I think Venezuela was second in that list with a 65% contraction in 5 years. And obviously this has carried, I mean, all the health, social, etc. issues that you might imagine. I mean, in Venezuela, I think 85% of the population is below the poverty line. I mean, there's a huge health crisis in Venezuela, humanitarian crisis, etc. They have a hyperinflation on top of this. So
which is also the longest.
Hyperinflation.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you have a huge collapse of the state in Venezuela. That's why we also show the data without Venezuela, because this contraction in economic activity in Venezuela is just an aberration, and it's basically something that we at the IMF are basically waiting to the moment in which Venezuela has a government that is willing to start rebuilding that economy to see how we can help, how can we support that. But this will be, I mean, they have a huge economic crisis, as I said, a humanitarian crisis. Obviously, there will be a large debt crisis, and because all the debt they accumulated in the past, it's not that in the last few years they have accumulated too much debt, but basically given that the denominator has disappeared, any level of debt now becomes an unsustainable burden of debt for that country. And lastly, as I said, they have a humanitarian, a debt, and an economic crisis. So let me, just in the interest of time, basically say what, in terms of the policy mix for Latin America, what are the levers that Latin America can use to help the economy recover from these very low rates of growth? I mean, on the one hand, I mean, one can think of fiscal policy, stimulating the economy through fiscal policy, and there, as we will see, Latin America doesn't have a lot of space. Why Latin America doesn't have a lot of space? Because since the global financial crisis and the declining commodity prices, growth in Latin America really slowed down. Latin America, on average, was growing at around 3.5%, and then it went to zero, and then you maybe have a couple of years of one, and now it's going back to zero. So during this whole period, I mean, most Latin American countries have been running primary deficits. And that means that debt to GDP continued to increase year after year, and in many cases increased by a lot. In some cases, also, the component of debt that was issued in foreign currency increased a lot because currencies also depreciated significantly. So you have, I mean, the accumulation of debt because the countries have primary deficit, and on top of that, the accumulation of debt or the increase in the ratio of debt to GDP because the currency depreciated and therefore the debt in dollars went up and the denominator did not go up as fast because inflation was much smaller than currency depreciation. So in that sense, there, on the fiscal side, I mean, countries in Latin America do not have a lot of space, because if they try to do something to stimulate the economy by pushing public finances, then maybe markets will not lend to them. And if that's the case, then it will be counterproductive, because interest rates will go to the roof, the private sector will not have access to capital markets, etc. So they have to have a very prudent approach, maybe on how fast they consolidate public finances, but it cannot be an important lever to push growth in the next few years. On monetary policy, there's a little bit more space. Why there's more space? Because throughout this whole period, for most of Latin American economies, inflation has been relatively well behaved. I mean, as we will see in many countries, inflation has remained within the 2 to 4% percent per year. That is the inflation target that most central banks in the region has established. And therefore, they have been lowering rates in the past 12 months. And they have space to continue to do that in case the economies do not recover. However, the channel of transmission of monetary policy to economic activity in Latin America is not that strong. However, it's one level of policies that they can do. And then you have, in the medium term, there are still...
Before you move, why does Mexico remain the country in Latin America with outlandishly high interest rates? What's special about Mexico?
Because now that Brazil has low rates, somebody has to take that place. I think it's a little bit of a policy mistake. I think the Central Bank of Mexico has been slow to reduce rates. I think the Central Bank of Mexico has had an approach that interest rates have to compensate country risk, and therefore, given the significant uncertainty, the policy uncertainty that was in the system, the Central Bank of Mexico thought that they have to compensate for that risk. My view is that, obviously, that country risk should be reflected in long-term rates, but short-term, I mean, if the probability that there's a debt default in 10 years increased by 100 basis points, maybe that the effect of that on the overnight rate should be at most 2 basis points. So I don't think the short-term rate should be accommodating for those increases in countries, but the Central Bank of Mexico has actually thought that it's important to avoid significant movements in the exchange rate, etc., that can alter those large investors that are invested, foreign investors that are invested in Mexican pesos, and they have felt that it was important to compensate whatever risk there was in the system through increases in rates and do not allow the currency to move as much. So they have been really slow, as we will see, in adjusting rates downward. The other important thing or difference in Mexico is that Mexico has not been really able to actually anchor inflation expectation at 3%, that is the central bank inflation target. But this is like a 6-year problem that Mexico has faced. And in that sense, the central bank kind of holds the fact that inflation expectations are not fully anchored at 3 as another argument to maintain high rates. So they have been much less willing than other central banks in the region to act in a counter-cyclical fashion. Now they're starting to do it, and I think also there's a political economy argument to that, to the extent that then you have a president who's actually questioned a lot of the paradigm of the Mexican economy, that part of that paradigm was to have a strong and credible central bank. But given that the current president is questioning the autonomy of some other entities, like the regulatory entity for the telecom sector, etc., I think the central bank is also thinking, well, we better move a little bit more than what we think is needed, also to protect the independence of the central bank. So we have been seeing that in the last few years. I think the second block of measures is much more oriented to the medium-term problems of Latin America. Latin America is a region of the world that actually grows at a relatively low pace when you compare it with other regions of the world. In the last 30 years, is a region maybe, if you take away, I mean, the effects of the commodity price cycle, etc., that has grown the least. And therefore, there are many structural issues that need to be tackled in Latin America for the region to grow. It's a region that doesn't save a lot, that doesn't invest a lot, that total factor productivity growth is extremely low. So in a sense, I mean, improving the quality of infrastructure and education, I mean, improving governance and the fight against corruption, opening further to trade. If you look, I mean, Latin America is kind of divided. You have the Pacific countries, like Chile, Peru, Colombia, Mexico, being very open to trade, maybe Colombia not that much. And then you have the Southern Cone countries, Argentina, Brazil, etc., being extremely protectionist. Basically, the countries in Mercosur being much more protectionist. No? So there's a lot of space to open up to trade in Latin America and to foreign direct investment, and obviously also making labor markets much more flexible might significantly increase the attractiveness of the region to FDI and therefore to activities that might generate TFP growth in the future. This is just some slides to show you a little bit. I mean, when you look at debt to GDP ratios in Latin America, I mean, there are many countries with ratios that are above 60% and with an important component in foreign currency. That is the red part of those columns. I mean, when you look, for example, at the case of Argentina, now Argentina has a debt to GDP ratio of 90% because the currency depreciated a lot. But you can see that a very important part of that debt is denominated in foreign currency. Why did they do this? Because, I mean, obviously these guys know that it's a risk that they will be taking. But given the history of Argentina, given the macroeconomic imbalances of Argentina, the only way they can borrow long-term is if they borrow in foreign currency. Or when they had borrowed in domestic currency, it was at very high rates in pesos. So at the end of the day, they either don't borrow and have to adjust the public finances, or they adjust a bit more gradually, but in the meantime, they actually have to go to the markets and borrow in foreign currency, but that makes them much more vulnerable to changes in the currency whenever a negative shock hits the country. And that's a problem that affects many economies in Latin America, and given this crisis, that is why, I mean, you can see how, I mean, both Argentina and Ecuador had to implement very restricted fiscal policies. That's why what we call the fiscal inputs is how much fiscal policy contributes to aggregate demand growth. Given that these countries run into important balance of payment crisis and fiscal crisis, they have to significantly adjust their public finances, and that's why the public finances have been actually subtracting from aggregate demand in the last few years, because given that there was nobody that was lending to them, they had to correct public finances very drastically. The rest of the countries are adjusting public finances very, very, very gradually, trying to basically move from primary deficit eventually to primary surpluses in a horizon between 2 and 4 and 4 years. In monetary policy, this is what I was telling you before. When you look at all the countries, basically the, I mean, now I forgot the labels, but the green dot, I think the green dot is the inflation in 2018. The red squares is inflation in 2019, and the black bars is expected inflation in 2020. You can see how every country except Uruguay, we don't have Argentina there, but every country except Uruguay has inflation within the target, and inflation has been within the target for the last 2 years and expected to remain there. And in some countries, actually, inflation has been below the target. So this means that central banks were able to use monetary policy as a counter-cyclical tool. And what we show in this graph is basically the latest real interest rate, real policy rate, that, for example, is negative in the case of Chile. It's almost zero in the case of Peru. And it's relatively low for the rest of the countries, as Andres was saying, except in the case of Mexico. And that's why we say there's still some room for countries in Latin America to continue to reduce the real interest rate to stimulate economic activity if activity does not increase to pick up. And there's significant amount of room in the case of Mexico that has a very high real policy rate for the reasons that we discussed before. I mean, this is some indicators of, let's say, the quality of infrastructure, economic attainment, etc., but basically showing that there's a lot of shortcomings in terms of structural policies in Latin America. In terms of corruption, I mean, Latin America looks relatively similar to other emerging markets, but significantly behind the levels, I mean, significantly worse than what we see in advanced economies. There are significant studies that show how, I mean, corruption negatively affects growth in the medium term. Then in the report we touch upon a couple of issues. One of them is basically the crisis in Venezuela. I mean, given that we don't have a dialogue at the IMF with Venezuela, the issue that we focus on is basically the effect that Venezuela is happening, is the effect that Venezuela is imposing in its neighbors. I mean, when we talk about economic contagion, traditionally we look at exports from other countries to the country that is suffering the problems. That is no longer the case because imports in Venezuela went from $60 billion per year to $5 billion per year in the last 5 years. So all the countries that could have been affected from this slowdown were already affected in the previous years. With respect to financial contagion, what we see in other crises like the Russian crisis, the Mexican crisis of 94, et cetera, is that when the crisis hit in Mexico, people not only started selling Mexican bonds and stocks, but also sold Argentinian bonds and stocks, Brazilian bonds and stocks. Part of that maybe was some linkages through economic activity, but the linkages between Mexico and these countries in terms of economic activity is relatively small. Maybe some of the effect is basically given that people got scared and maybe started thinking how complex a sovereign debt restructuring happening in Mexico would be. Maybe they started rethinking how risk that maybe the risk of holding emerging market assets was higher than what they thought, and that led them to sell some of those. And maybe there was also technical issues. I mean, if you're an emerging market fund in the US and you're holding a bunch of Latin American papers, and maybe your fund has a lot of deposits from some pension funds in Iowa, and the pension fund manager in Iowa doesn't know the difference between Buenos Aires and Rio de Janeiro, but it's investing in these bonds and it's getting some good return, et cetera. But when you have a crisis in Argentina, maybe the guy says, okay, forget about it. I don't want to have any of my portfolio invested in Latin America. And then these guys start redeeming their investment in emerging market funds, and then the emerging market fund has to sell some of their positions, not only in Mexico, but everywhere, because the fund is getting smaller and they have to sell those positions. That's a more technical type of contagion. But all of those things, if they happen in Venezuela, they happen way before. Now, the main issue through which Venezuela is having an effect on the other countries of Latin America is basically through migration. As of today, almost 4.5 million Venezuelans, Venezuela population is 30 million, almost 4.5 million Venezuelans have left Venezuela. If migration continue at this pace, this level of migration might go from 4.5 million to 10 million in 3 years. And obviously it's affecting Latin American countries first because they have to absorb this increasing population in their labor market. They have to provide this population with basic health and education services. And that is creating some strains in countries in Latin America. Obviously, the country most affected is Colombia, in which almost 1.5 million people from Venezuela have arrived, but also, I mean, in the case of Chile, you have had a significant number of Venezuelan arriving, and that is creating some tension because wages are not rising as fast as they were increasing before. Maybe some jobs are being lost by locals to the newcomers from another country, generating some kind of social tension. So that's a process that needs to be basically managed by public policy. If you see, I mean, this is the line that shows how much, the amount of migration that has taken place away from there, from Venezuela, and this is a projection if this process continues for 8 years. As you see, I mean, the pattern is similar to the Syrian migration crisis that started in 2012, and if it continues, I mean, maybe in a couple of years, it crosses that line, and it can become in 2 or 3 years the major migratory movement that we have seen, let's say, in the 21st century.
In peacetime, it must be a record, right?
Yeah.
Venezuela had, what, 25 million people before?
Yeah.
So that would be nearly a third of the population.
If this continues, And the comparison that we did in terms of the contraction in the Venezuelan economy, I mean, basically, even when it was the second largest contraction in history, it was the only one that actually happened in peacetime. So basically, all the other data points that we have in that sample, in which economies have contracted by 50% or by 60%, have actually happened in transition economies or in conflict economies. So this is the only, well, it's not a gender bias here, it's a man-made disaster because they were men, no? So basically, these are some estimates of what will be the burden on public finances that this will create on different countries in Latin America. What could be the effect on growth? The effect on growth in our models is positive, because given that the government has to spend more money to provide education, etc., we're modeling this as an aggregate supply shock. And in the medium term, it will be a positive aggregate supply shock. But obviously, there are important transition issues that need to be addressed. And these problems, although we focus in Colombia, in Peru and in Chile, because the nominal numbers are very high. For some islands in the Caribbean that are very small, I mean, we're seeing maybe an increase in the labor force of one-third of the Venezuelans that are coming. So when you look at Curaçao, Guyana, etc., this is in Trinidad and Tobago, this is a much more important factor given the small size of their economies. Let me just... And then the other topic that we address in the report is basically what could be the effect of trade tensions on Latin America. First, I mean, basically, we kind of address what would be the effect on the world economy, and we look how trade tensions have affected the U.S. and China. I mean, the four lines that we have first are basically the sheer effects of tariffs. And we run the effects of tariffs that have been imposed and will be imposed or have already been announced by the U.S. and China on the U.S. economy and China. Basically, a level effect at the most of 40 basis points in the case of the U.S., and basically it can get out to 100 basis points in the case of China. Then when we add into this the uncertainty effect working through the adjustment in the stock market, or basically funding spreads, or uncertainty, because even if you want to do an investment, then you will do it in any circumstance, but you don't know if you want to do it in China or in Vietnam or in Indonesia, and that will depend on the level of tariffs. You just wait until there's more clarity of how high tariffs will be, and then you decide where to put your funding. So when you include those effects, basically the effects on China and the U.S. could be much larger than what we thought. Then we feed this into the models for the Latin American economies, and basically what we see is that if the Chinese economy slows down, the countries in Latin America that are mostly affected are Chile, Costa Rica, and Peru, especially the cases of Peru and Chile are basically mineral exporting economies, copper, silver, etc., and the growth in China has been heavily intensive on these metals, and therefore the link is through commodity prices. When you look at how a slowdown in the U.S. economy affects growth in Latin America, basically Mexico and Costa Rica are the countries mostly affected, because these are the countries that have the strongest links to the U.S. through exports, through remittances, and through tourism. The second component, that is the orange component, is basically the financial channel. So if trade tensions really intensify, it's highly likely that will generate, again, through the uncertainty channel, an increase in uncertainty, and through that in financing costs for the region. And the orange effect is basically how much this increase in financing costs will affect the different Latin American economies. And obviously, the size of this column is highly linked to the external financing needs of each economy. If your economy doesn't need to fund itself with foreign savings, then the effect will be relatively small. If you're an economy that is highly dependent on borrowing from abroad, then if financial conditions tighten, that will have a larger effect on your country when uncertainty in the world economy increases. So basically, those are the two special issues that we analyze in the report. And Jorge will basically talk about or summarize three studies that were done in the context of the outlook.
Basically, we used to produce a report that had the conjuncture, the projections, and three analytical factors. but we are contributing to save the world, so we're not publishing the chapters anymore in the book, so you can find them in the webpage. But they are usually associated with issues that we need to study in order to support our baseline projections. And we're going to talk about capital flows in the aftermath of the commodity super cycle. We're going to talk later on fiscal consolidation and sovereign spreads, and finally, labor market dynamics and informality over the cycle in Latin America and the Caribbean. Now, we had done a study on capital flows previously over the commodity price super cycle, and in most regressions were dominated by the terms of trade. So since capital flows are at the center of what we analyzed, we decided to take a second look at the issue and see what was driving capital flows in the aftermath of the price bust of the commodities. And if I can get your attention to the middle chart here, you can see that since 2013, which is when commodity prices started to fall, you can see that foreign direct investment, the blue line, comes down from about 4% of GDP to around 3% of GDP. Okay. Whereas if you look at what's happening in advanced economies and other emerging markets, you can see that in the last 2 years, foreign direct investment has actually collapsed. For some reason that we are not 100% clear yet, foreign direct investment has been quite resilient in Latin America. But if you look at portfolio investments, they have gone from more than 3 percentage points of GDP to around 1%. Okay. And you can see also that they have become very volatile. So we focus our study now on what's going on, what is driving portfolio flows. And when we look at that, we do see actually a big change in behavior. What you see here, the purple bars, is the coefficient of the sensitivity of capital flows, portfolio flows, to external factors, factors that the countries do not control, in this case, global risk aversion measured by the VIX coefficient. And if you look at that, this is for the full sample, 2000 to 2018, you can see we had an elasticity of around 0.07 that more than doubles in the more recent period. So capital flows are coming down, they are more volatile, and they are much more sensitive to external factors, which are warning signals for us. And it's the same is happening vis-a-vis portfolio flows on different growth differentials. If growth differentials, for instance, in Asia, growth is much more than Latin America, that means that the response of portfolio flows for the whole sample is around 0.25. You can see it almost tripled for the more recent period, meaning if now we're having a growth that is close to zero, definitely you have a negative differential. This could be conspiring against sustaining the capital flows that the region needs so badly. So we, after looking at that, we say, well, are we actually vulnerable to the riskiest scenario of this, which is what is called a sudden stop? And we look at the usual indicators for a sudden stop, and we see that except for Argentina and Ecuador that already have had a sudden stop, the rest of the countries are in a relatively okay position. Actually, the third most vulnerable one is Chile. Actually, it's something to keep an eye on. But as a result of that, we concluded, well, there is not such a huge risk factor at this time. But nevertheless, we did a little bit of an investigation on what are the policies that countries follow to confront a sudden stop, or if you want, outflows in capital flows. And you see that in Latin America, both fiscal contractions and monetary contractions are used quite a bit. Basically, the message from the paper is that flexible exchange rates are the best line of defense vis-a-vis a reversal of capital flows. And sometimes you can use monetary policy, tightening of monetary policy, to defend a little bit the exchange rate whenever the depreciation associated with the capital reversal can damage balance sheets because of a lot of that liability dollarization. So that's in a nutshell the results from the paper. I'm not going to go through the regression. The second chapter.
Could you answer me?
Sorry? Flexible
exchange is supposed to be great, but not everybody really flows. Whenever exchange rates really depreciate, everybody seems to intervene, including the central bank of my own skinny country last week.
Well, that's a variable that is two variables, right? Either floating or not float. So we are not getting into the shaded areas where you have some intervention or non-intervention. This is in general countries that are much more floating than fixing, but the shades of gray that you get and intervention, we cannot control for that. So, but in any case, it comes extremely significant, the exchange rate. And monetary tightening actually helps to reduce the duration of the capital, of the sun stock. And on fiscal, we don't get significant results because, you know, on the one hand, you are reducing aggregate demand, and that is not helping, even though it's helping you on the sustainability of that. So it's expected that that coefficient should not be significant. We do not find a clear coefficient on capital controls. So the second chapter is on fiscal consolidation and sovereign spreads. As Alejandro mentioned, most of the countries in the region have to face a process of fiscal consolidation, and we do know that this is, in general, doesn't help with economic activity. So we did studies previously estimating the fiscal multipliers and how you can do a fiscal consolidation the best way possible in order to minimize the impact on economic activity. What we did this time around is try to see one channel through which fiscal consolidation can help. And this is if you manage to lower spreads and interest rates in some countries. This is a literature that is highly controversial, even in advanced economies. You may have heard about the debate about austerity or not. And then one of the problems that we have is that there are no good identification methodologies to look at the shock on the fiscal side and see how that affects activity. So in order to improve on that, what our economists decided to do is to use a text mining approach and identify clear episodes in which there is an announcement that the government is going to do a fiscal consolidation, either increase taxes or reduce government spending, and look at the impact of that consolidation on sovereign spreads. Okay. I'm not going to go into the technicalities if somebody wants. Basically, we use this methodology of local projections, which is basically impulse responses, but with more flexibility and allowing you for non-linear effects. Basically, what we find is that whenever there is an announcement that you're going to do a fiscal consolidation, 1 month later, you have a reduction in sovereign spreads of around 50 basis points. Okay. Now, when you look at and divide the sample into those countries that start with fiscal crisis or very high level of spreads, and you announce the consolidation, the impact is much larger. You can get a reduction of up to 35 basis points in those stress cases. And also, if you do that in the context of an IMF program, the reduction in spreads is also more than 30 basis points. Now, that is the initial effect that you have. We haven't talked about our main goal, which is to see what is the impact on economic activity. So with that new database that the economists created, that is basically covering a number of newspapers in the region that are summarized in Dow Jones Factiva's database, after we do that identification of the episodes, we put that into a panel vector autoregression where we have monthly activity data. Okay. And there what we do is a counterfactual exercise in which we say, okay, the fiscal consolidation was announced, there was a reduction in spreads, what is the impact on activity? And we do find that the impact on activity is around 6%. Okay. We don't know the size of the shock here, we know just an announcement of consolidation, but bear with me that this is what happens when you engage into this fiscal consolidation 12 months after the fact. What then we
that's,
do...
That's cleaning out from the effect of the direct effect of the shock. This is the marginal effect of the fiscal consolidation.
Correct. And you have a VAR which has a few other control values. And what we do is using a new methodology through which you can shut down the channel of the moving sovereign spreads. Okay? So basically, this is the baseline effect. And if you were to shut down the reduction in spreads that we identify as the main channel of the help that you can get from a consolidation, when you shut that down, the reduction in activity is much more. Okay, that's basically the main result. The devil is in the details. Apparently, if you do a consolidation with expenditure, the reduction in spreads is also much more than if you do it with taxes. Okay, and if you have a large adjustment, the evidence is not so clear, but probably you get another adjustment. And we have a few more results on the impact of this on economic activity. Now, the third one is related to the issue of labor dynamics and informality. And there are two or three reasons or motivations for doing this study. One of them is that over the commodity super cycle, we saw a huge improvement in real incomes, employment, and actually formalization of the labor force. And there is the concern that once the commodity prices have collapsed, those gains are gonna be gone. So we started looking at what could allow for a sustainability, if you want, of those gains in real income, employment, and so on and so forth. Also another issue, we're seeing a very moderate recovery for next year. And one of the concerns that we have is that in most of the countries in Latin America, what we're seeing is increases in informal jobs, but not necessarily informal jobs, informal jobs that are much more productive and tend to lead to more growth. The methodology that we use here is something popularized by Tesaran, which is basically a panel where you can allow for country differences in the main elasticities, say, whatever variable from the labor market that you choose here, you say unemployment or informality relative to GDP, you can have variation country by country, and also you can have common shocks. Say if there is a productivity shock or a world interest rate shock that affects all countries in the same way, then you will have independent disturbances. So that's on the technicalities of the issue. But the going back to the motivation, you can see that if you look at unemployment in Latin America, beginning in the 2000s, it was around 12% and came down like a rock with the commodity price super cycle. Right? And the concern is what actually we're seeing now, and this is driven mostly by Brazil, that there is a pickup in unemployment. Now, if you compare to the dynamic...
Those are weighted or unweighted?
Those are weighted, I believe. Yes. And but if you look at advanced economies, basically the U.S. in red, you can see here you have the Lehman, the financial crisis. The U.S. went from an unemployment of around 5% to 10%, but then it came down like a rock. This is an economy that has very flexible labor markets, whereas if you look at the rest of the OECD, you see that unemployment went from 6% to above 8 and has been coming down, but very, very marginal. Again, the motivation for this is there may be very different forces.
I don't see what you see there.
Sorry?
Because it didn't go up as much.
No, exactly.
And it's back to where it was, right?
Yes. Okay. So if you want the... yes. But the point is to say basically that the dynamics of labor markets in Latin America vis-a-vis the others is quite different.
Yeah.
And it's slightly different between the U.S. and others. Now, on informality, we do know that the main reasons why informality can be reduced are basically two: GDP growth and more education. Okay. So before getting into the more cyclical aspects, we look at sort of trends in the last 15, 20 years. And you can see there are some countries, like Colombia, for instance, that have reduced informality substantially, the same with Brazil. Peru also, but continues to have a very high level of informality. And Chile has reduced it a little bit, but not so much. Whereas Mexico, despite having some GDP, non-trivial GDP growth in this period, has seen an increase in informality. So having those trends in mind, we move on to look deeper than what traditional macroeconomists would look into the labor market, which is unemployment. Okay, you have here the cases of Chile and Colombia. If you look at the whole period in the early 2000s and you focus on unemployment, you would see that the change in unemployment is minimal. Okay, it's practically zero. But if you look at the change in the demand for formal labor, which is these rows, bars, it's huge. And there was a big response from the supply of labor, both in terms of working age population, participation, and formalization. In other words, there is much more to the dynamics of the labor markets than looking at the dynamics of unemployment. So that's what we do, and the first tool that a macroeconomist uses is what is called the Okun's law. This is the relationship between the changes in unemployment and the changes in GDP, and we find that both in Latin America and most other emerging markets, the Okun's law coefficient is smaller than in advanced economies. That is, unemployment reacts less to the economic cycle than in the advanced economies. And we relate that to the level of informality, and there's a very clear correlation, negative correlation. The more informality you have, the less response of unemployment to the cycle in GDP. And this is what I would say the positive aspect of informality. If you want, whenever you face a slowdown in economic activity, workers, rather than being fully unemployed, they do find informal jobs that allow them to have some source of income. Now, there is, on the other hand, a negative aspect of informality, which is the one we're going to take a look at next. But before that, actually, two key ratios. We correlated a lot of the level of informality in these countries with a number of institutional features of the labor market, doing business, World Economic Forum, ILO, and the more significant negative correlations between positive correlations, informality, is with the minimum wage ratio to productivity. That is, countries where the minimum wage deviates too much from average productivity, you have higher informality. And those countries in which redundancy cost, in terms of the weeks of salary that you have to pay to a worker that has been fired, is largest, that leads also to much higher informality.
But the R square of that regression line must be
yes.
0.1, right?
Absolutely. There is a correlation, clearly.
If you take out the outliers on the right, you get nothing.
Yeah.
No, but
this is illustrative. There is a paper, a working paper, that is listed in this chapter. I don't remember the number exactly, but in which they do a much more direct econometric analysis, and they do find clearly that these are the largest determinants. Okay, we use this for exposition and purposes.
But it's not a criticism, but it's striking how it's striking all over the place the scatterplot is.
So what do we do? Like I said before, we look at kind of the positive thing of informality being a buffer in the downturns, providing some income to those who otherwise would be unemployed. In order to dig a little bit deeper into the issue of what's going on with labor markets and institutional features like the ones I just mentioned, we follow a methodology introduced by four famous Chilean economists. Although the most famous one is not included in that study, but sorry. And we basically move away from what would be just the typical Okun's law study, and we add something having to do with the speed of adjustment to some disequilibrium in the labor market. Here we have employment, and this is sort of what would be equilibrium employment relative to GDP. And here we have a more microeconomic model of the labor market, where you have the desirable or the optimal employment in a given sector relative to actual employment. Now, to make a long story short, we find that in Latin America is slower than other emerging markets and advanced economies in restoring equilibrium in the labor markets after the shock. And we do find that that little parameter, the speed of adjustment, is around 0.5. You see the coefficient on that employment gap is 0.5. And whenever you interact that coefficient with a number of features, you will see that if you interact the employment coefficient on the employment gap with being in Latin America, that has a negative statistically significant coefficient, which means the speed of adjustment is slower. Then if you do the same with informality, same thing. And then we interact with the two things that I mentioned before, job security and minimum wages relative to productivity, as well as with government effectiveness, because if you have those rules in the book, but you do not enforce them, then the impact should not be so strong. And we do get clear statistical coefficients, again, that job security slows the speed of adjustment and high minimum wages to productivity substantially reduce the speed of adjustment. To be sure, then we correlate these issues with other macro variables. For example, if you see here the employment gap with exchange rate flexibility, and definitely exchange rate flexibility increases the speed of adjustment. So we were surprised that with this very sectoral data, using the variation that you can get with a cross-country dimension, we do get quite reasonable results. We do know that in order to do good policy in labor markets, you have to go to micro-level data. But we were happy to see that we could isolate both these positive and negative effects of informality. Again, it can be a buffer in recessions, but it can slow down the recovery of the labor market after a shock. And why is that this happens? Because usually you would think that if you have a large informal market, that is a very flexible labor market, because it's avoiding all the regulations, right? So if it's avoiding the regulations, a labor market with high informality should adjust faster. And the reason is there's a big discussion in the literature, and we refer to it more based in micro-level studies, is basically you have a lot of segmentation in the labor market. And when the level of economic activity, for example, picks up, you can hire and attract some workers that are in the informal sector, but when you need skilled labor, you don't have it. So basically, that segmentation of the labor market is being negative in the sense that it does not allow some workers to move from the informal sector to more productive jobs in the formal sector. And that, again, reduces the speed of adjustment, and we have some back-of-the-envelope calculations. If you were to move from a situation where you have high government effectiveness, say, and you were to lower job security, you would increase the speed of adjustment, and that would add half percentage points to the growth of labor productivity. Now, we also discussed what you could do in terms of changing regulations, but again, we don't claim to have solutions for all these problems. Another thing we wanted to point out is that looking at four dimensions of the regulations in the labor market, again, severance payments, or if you want, job security, unemployment protection or unemployment insurance, collective bargaining, and the ratio of the minimum wage to productivity, you can see that the purple is Latin America, and the red is advanced economies. Well, the regulations in terms of job security and the ratio of the minimum wage to relative productivity is higher or tighter, if you want, than in the advanced economies. Okay. So we do not say that you have to go ahead and reduce job security right away, but we do encourage different countries to look at a possible trade-off, for instance, between reducing severance payments and having a more elaborate system of unemployment insurance. That is, rather than having the employer to pay for somebody that loses the job, we have an insurance mechanism managed by the state or somebody else that could take care and guarantee some income for those workers. So that's basically the three messages that we have in the chapters.
Many thanks, Jorge. Okay. We're running a little bit behind time. I want to make sure that we have Veronica's comments. So I will keep listening from here, if that's okay. The floor is yours.
Is not here?
That's still ours, you know.
So what I decided to do, I'm not going to say much about the forecast because, of course, they are the best at doing this. So what I tried to do is, I'm not saying you are good, you are the best. But what I'm going to do is try to put this a little bit in context, how challenging the times are for Latin America. So basically, we heard a lot about the commodity super cycle that led or coincided with a huge increase in growth and also a lot of social improvements. And lately, we have seen a slowdown both in growth but also some social unrest. So I want to touch base on that and then ask ourselves a little bit what Alex basically was asking, what next? What can we do next given this potential slowdown in the region, some progress, structural reform and fiscal consolidation, and touch a little bit of a flavor of what Jorge was saying. Is the region finally ready or has enough space to implement some counter-cyclical policies or at least some smoothing? The first thing I want to do is the same exact graph that Alex showed before, but since 2000 instead of 2010. So you have a little bit of a better flavor of how much actually economies increased and what is it that we talk about when we talk about super cycle. If you can see that actually the price of commodities from 2000 to 2010, sometimes, I don't know, it was multiplied by 3. And it went down quite dramatically, and although the forecast is about some recovery, the recovery is not complete. What happened in growth? Well, in growth, apart from the financial crisis in 2009, that actually was not really that bad in Latin America because it was so fast, the recovery, that we almost do not feel it. But you can see how much the economy improved between 2000 and 2010, and how in 2011, when we see the slowdown in commodity prices, we also see a slowdown in growth. And again, there's some forecast of a recovery later on, but not very fast. And look at the poverty rate. I put there 2000, 2010, and 2017, and that poverty rate is not your usual poverty rate because it tries to be homogeneous across countries, so it's PPP, purchasing power parity control, the number of people, proportion of people with less than $5.5 per day. And you can see that there was a huge improvement from 2000 to 2010, and although there's a continuation later, it is slowed down. It definitely slowed down in Argentina, it is slowed down in Brazil, it is slowed down in Bolivia, it continued, but at a slower rate in the rest of these big countries. And I chose 5.5 and not another number because I want to call your attention to the new middle class. So we are not talking about extreme poverty. A lot of these countries are middle-income countries, not extreme poverty countries. And what we see here is that there was a huge proportion of new middle-class population that improve a lot of their condition, but it's quite vulnerable. It's very new middle class and quite there in the limit. And finally, I think this is a super cool graph. This is from Gasparini et al., the CEDLAC, and the World Bank. What you can divide is commodity exporters and non-commodity exporters. From the 90s until today, commodity exporters is mostly South America, maybe without Uruguay, and we can add Mexico. And non-commodity exporters is mostly Central America, Dominica, and Uruguay. And what you can see is the 90s in all the region is a region where the income inequality increased quite a bit. And you can see that in both regions. But a lot of that was happening together with huge structural reforms that were going to actually reverse back to mean in the following era. And you can see that happening in non-commodity exporters, where there was a huge increase in inequality that you can observe in the red line, and then it reversed back after the overshooting of some of these structural reforms. In commodity exporter countries, what you see in green is the terms of trade, which is a lot driven by this commodity super cycle. And you see how the Gini coefficient was very high, and when in year 2000, during the 90s, and when in year 2000 prices started to improve a lot, you see huge drops in inequality. And once that we see that reversal after 2010, it plateaued. And actually, if you can continue this, it stops in 2015, but for some countries, we can continue sometimes even reverse. So what we observe in the next graph is dissatisfaction with democracy in Latin America. And it has very much the same shape. It actually improved a lot up to 2010, and it reversed it later. Why am I showing this? I'm showing this because there's some policy uncertainty and policy risk around it. So it's not only about growth, it's not only about a slowdown of growth, but actually there were huge improvement in the economies of a lot of these countries during these years that now are a little bit under question. And I wanted to compare that with the graph that Jorge was just mentioning, which is, well, what can we do next? Should we do a structural reform, fiscal consolidation? And there's this super cool graph about the effect of fiscal consolidation. And basically, after announced, you see a reduction in the spreads. And if you see conditional on observing the reduction in a spread, even though there's a negative effect of fiscal consolidation on activity, if there's a big reduction in interest rate associated with the measures, the cost in terms of activity maybe is not as tough. And I want to put a grain of, not grain of salt, but just, you know, this is Argentina around the time we announced the agreement with the IMF. We don't see any change in country risk or interest rate. It's something went the other way around. And I want to point that out, that sustainability, that when you do fiscal consolidation, when you try to pass those reforms, you are aiming at sustainability of the policy. You want to have sustainable fiscal side of the economy. But sustainable is not only about how tough the fiscal side is, but also what is the consensus around it. Because at the end of the day, consensus, political support and social support around passing them is what is going to give you the continuation of those measures. And if the risk of not continuing this fiscal consolidation is there, maybe backfires. And this is what actually happened in Argentina around the day of the primary elections, when indeed probably there was not, in the middle of a recession, there was not support for a lot of these policies. So actually, if we observe there what happened with the nominal exchange rate, it went from 45 to almost 60. The stock index basically was reduced by half in overnight, country risk triple, and the dollar deposits dropped by, I don't know, 30-40%. So this, what tells you is that, well, if there's not political support, some basic consensus around the policies you're implementing, then you risk a reversal, and even though nothing happened economically overnight, it's a huge effect. The other thing that I want to point out is that I don't want with this to sound, well, maybe structural reforms or fiscal consolidation is not the way to go, because actually there are a lot of improvements in the region because a lot of this fiscal consolidation and structural reform took place. And a lot of it is something that Alex mentioned, is there is a space for countercyclical policies in Latin America. Well, in the past, Latin America was not a region. I don't think there was any country that could implement countercyclical policies. Why? Well, because when you have a shock, like, for example, a commodity shock, it tends to be happening at the same time as capital flow reversal, and Jorge basically picked that up. And when you have that capital flow reversal, the market shut down, and you just do not have anybody willing to lend money so the government can have a countercyclical fiscal policy. There's a lack of confidence in the currency, so when you see something like that, a lot of even not only foreign investors but local investors, households, might want to buy dollars instead of local currency. So you will need to increase the interest rate and make the peso, the investment in peso, more attractive. So you end up increasing interest rate during recessions. And something that Andres was pointing out, there's a lot of dollar-denominated sovereign debt and private debt, so there's a lot of fear of floating, so the exchange rate also has limited effects. But turns out that there were many big improvements during these 20 years, and some of it I'm actually borrowing from the IMF. I think it's the previous report, no? This is the pass-through of exchange rate devaluations, depreciation to prices. And if you see in Latin America, it went down quite a lot from 2007 to 2015. Basically, what it says is that the inflation expectations in the country are well anchored. So when there's some fluctuation in the exchange rate, inflation is not necessarily picking up. And all of a sudden, by having a more sustainable, a more consistent monetary policy with well-anchored expectations, you regain monetary policy, which you didn't really have as a true instrument before. So those countries that manage to have better monetary policies, they regain a tool that potentially can be used. As Alex was saying, this might not be the case for fiscal policy, because the debt to GDP actually increased quite a bit after 2010, but still, if you see, there's some countries here that actually managed to reduce a lot debt to GDP, that have quite healthy fiscal side of the economy, and probably they have more room to implement, or at least if not having countercyclical fiscal policy, not having it too procyclical. On the other hand, you have Argentina, you have Ecuador, that have to be super, super aggressive negatively at the time of fiscal, at the time of a recession. So I just want to point out how difficult the times are. We don't know whether the fast growth era is really over, or you guys point at some downside risks. What will happen to that new middle class? Are we witnessing a reversal in terms of economic policy? And if that reversal will turn to fair societies or just unsustainable fiscal path, it's a little bit of risk. And there's something that we still do not know, is how to diversify our economy. We tend to say we need a structural reforms to improve TFP, to improve education. We just don't know what those structural reforms are. We wish we knew more about development that we know. So more than saying anything about the forecast, I just wanted to put these things in perspective. Thank you.
All right, guys, we're almost out of time, but we may have a few minutes for a question or two to Jorge or to Alejandro, to Veronica, not to me. I have nothing to say. Or to add after all this wisdom. And she has to run in exactly 30 seconds because she's going to the airport. So we'll just keep our IMF guys. Muchas gracias.
Muchas gracias.
Excellent. Floor is open. Yes, back there.
Hi. So I have a question for Alejandro. I'm from Colombia. And you're mentioning like the public finances pressure we're facing, especially because of the migration from Venezuela. And now the government is discussing a tax reform. I guess you know about it. And they basically are just creating more tax exemptions and more social expenditure. So it's basically they're creating new revenue, but it's not enough to cover the exemptions and the social expenditure they're planning. So I just want to know like what thoughts you have about it and how would that impact the forecast you already have that I saw you downloaded, like down, put it down.
Yeah. Let's collect a couple of questions. Yes, right here.
Yeah, I'm from China, professor from China, and now research fellow at the IGA. Yes, it's like that. I think that you know that what is going on in China, and actually I came here to expect Latin American and Caribbean can have a better performance and offer us kind of market can which can moderate the impact of American and the US-China war. But after your presentation, it gives me a feeling that it's a slowdown. If I can point out the positive side is the monetary policy, the inflation control give me a feeling can be reached. Okay, my question is that you said that one of the reasons is China. Actually, I'm paying close attention to about the U.S. What, for example, 100 years ago, Argentina is a very great country. Even 10 years ago, Venezuela is, economic situation is very good, was very good. Okay, how do you find the American side effect? I mean that it is that without America, without the U.S., you would be better or worse. And on the nowadays situation, to what extent is out of the U.S., politically or economically? Thank you very much.
All right. We have about a minute. But I'm sure these two wise guys can condensate their wisdom. So we have one question about Colombia and one question about the U.S., China, and the world.
I can do
both if you want. On Colombia, actually, the growth in Colombia has not been cut down. It's at 3.4 for this year and 3.5 for next. Colombia is one of the top performers in the region and actually did an excellent adjustment to the collapse in the terms of trade and is doing quite well. Now, there is a struggle, yes, with complying with the fiscal rule, which is relatively tight, I would say. And, you know, there is a number of social indicators in Colombia that definitely need to be improved. And there is, you mentioned tax reform, but a pension reform is definitely urgent because there's very little access to pensions, and pensions are tremendously unequal in Colombia. So if you add to that the recent demonstrations and the social tensions, it is very, very, very complicated. I wouldn't want to be in their shoes, but... I don't know if you want to add something to that.
I think, addressing the China US issue for Latin America, obviously that's a super broad topic, and we're definitely not experts on that. But I think there's one clear point in the sense that the historical relationship between Latin America and the US. Yeah. Has not been great for Latin America because Latin America has not started to converge to US GDP per capita. So it's only you only have a few countries in Latin America that have shown a convergence process to to the U.S. So that maybe it's only idiosyncratic factors, and there was nothing that the U.S. could have done. But what is clear is that, the economic relationship between the U.S. and Latin America has not been one that has provided Latin America with the dynamism to overcome some of its shortcomings and actually engineer a self-sustaining convergent process to U.S. GDP per capita standards. The medium-term relationship between China and Latin America, it's still to be developed. We have just seen, the initial decade of this. There are some good stories. There are also some stories of very problematic stories for China. No? A lot of lending to Venezuela that did not pan out. I don't know financially how that story will end. But from the point of view of development and lending into a project, one cannot claim that that was something that has evolved right. No? And I think there's a lot of learning on the Chinese side on how to engage with these countries, both financially and politically. And we have seen significant changes in the way Chinese lending is evolving, etc. And I think it can be a very interesting relationship. I think Latin American countries should veer towards Asia because that's where growth is going to come in the next two decades. And they have to build long-lasting relationships with Asia that are also productive from the point of view of what Latin American countries are looking for. And just to conclude on Colombia, when we finished this forecast, Colombia looked quite well in the sense that from the Pacific Rim countries was the one that was growing the most. As Jorge said, the adjustment to the decline in the price of oil had already completed in Colombia. Since that, the Supreme Court rejected the previous tax reform that was approved last year. Then they were resubmitting it to Congress. Then important social demonstrations took place, and then the president announced significant tax concessions, etc. So we need to understand how all of this is going to add up. But obviously, it's a negative issue. Regardless of where the cancellation of the previous tax reform, and even if the new one is actually accepted, I think it will actually hinder the political capital of the Duque government to push other reforms or to do other things. So it eats into a thin political capital that they have now. And obviously, the social demonstrations are actually even added more problems into the capacity to do things and veering a little bit towards a more populistic bend. And I think, just to conclude, I think you hear from a lot of political analysts and commentators of Colombia that kind of responsible macroeconomic framework that was kind of a cornerstone of economic policy in Colombia, that might be changing once that the peace agreement was signed with the FARC and that maybe a left-wing candidacy for the president seems to be more palatable for Colombian society, one that is not no longer that associated with the guerrilla movement, can actually significantly increase uncertainty in policy making in Colombia, closer to where we see it in other Latin American countries. And Colombia can gradually converge a little bit more to the Latin American median in terms of macroeconomic uncertainty. You know, that's something that we'll need to see. But I think all of this phenomenon that has happened in the last few months point that there has been a marginal increase in that direction. No?
Welcome to the club, Colombia. All right, everybody, please join me in giving our